Welcome back to Baroque Sunbursts, the music and philosophy sideshow from Zero and Repeater, currently being brought to you by Adam and Craig of Acid Horizon. Today, we are joined by yet another musician and a musicologist who actually came on Acid Horizon quite a few years ago, actually, kind of in the earlier days. We're of course, once again joined by David Burke, who is a musicologist and indeed a musician in the band Absent Signifier, one of the pioneers of so-called free metal, which I'm definitely going to dive into at some point during this conversation. But today we're here to talk about music and enjoyment. That's right, folks. We're turning into the work of Jacques Lacan, his theories of enjoyment or jouissance, if you want to put it in the French Lacanese. And we're going to talk about how we enjoy music, how we ourselves as musicians have experienced the enjoyment, and in a way, how that relates to different kinds of genres. Do we have a phallic enjoyment in death metal? Do we have feelings of embodiment and directedness in dance music? How is R&B filtered through the social field? These are all questions we're going to be tearing apart, getting our teeth into today. But first and foremost, I just want to welcome David back to the show.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, thanks for name-dropping the band as well. I mean, we'll get there. I was doing some digging the other day, and I found that a couple of people have used the phrase free metal, but only very recently, I think really in the last year. And it's one of those an idea whose time has come moments, perhaps. Of course, it sounds like shit.
and that isn't that why we enjoy it in metal? But but for just to give people kind of a refresher from the last episode, just tell us what your sort of project is, because we know you're working on a PhD at the moment in musicology, particularly around metal. But I know, of course, our conversation today will sort of go a lot further beyond that. But just ask us, what are you working on at the moment?
So my PhD is a combination of ethnography, a little bit of musicology, and some media studies. And what I'm interested in is how heavy metal kind of persists and continues, because it's a relatively consistent and long-lasting subculture that's now coming up to, 50. It's 55 this year now. And I'm kind of charting the ways in which, despite maintaining a sort of core of continuity, the past 20 years have seen a kind of a really interesting shift in metal culture, where it's moved from something that previously was considered quite socially transgressive to something that is less so, but it continues to evolve and develop. And that's interesting from within metal studies, because we've assumed in the field that transgression is this kind of great motor which makes metal continue and evolve and change as it finds new taboos to cross. But my research suggests that actually there might be something beyond transgression that kind of powers metal. And as I got into that idea, I hit on the idea that what metal is really dealing with are psychoanalytic concepts, and specifically around death drive. And it's the death drive which produces enjoyment. So my project that I hope to begin after the PhD will be a kind of tying together metal and psychoanalysis, but then that just led to lots of little avenues around music and the way we enjoy it specifically. There's a scholar, Michel Filipov, who in 2012 posed a question around understanding death metal, and she tried to get us to understand what are the pleasures that death metal listeners have when they experience the music. And that really sat with me, and eventually it turned into not what is the pleasure of listening to metal, but how do we enjoy it?
So let's unpack that term enjoyment, because of course beforehand you sent to us like an incredibly sort of useful handout breaking down a lot of these psychoanalytic concepts. But let's start with just getting to the basics here. So what is enjoyment, particularly in the Lacanian framework you're using, and how does one contrast that with, say, pleasure?
Great. Yeah, no, absolutely. So the way Freud originally puts this is that pleasure is the pleasure principle is a homeostatic idea, that you want to return to a zero level of excitation. He's really concerned with not with pleasure as necessarily as the thing that we experience consciously, but as a limiting of the body's excitations. So ultimate pleasure might be summarized as, you've got your feet up, you're in a relaxed maybe prone position. All of your needs are satisfied. You are without any itch or restlessness to go and do something. You are completely at ease. And that's what, for Freud, that's what characterizes maximal pleasure. But enjoyment is the counterpart to this. Enjoyment is that precise, you see I'm doing it now, but that precise motion of excitation in the body where suddenly you are stimulated, suddenly you are excited by something. There are lots of ways that people characterize this. Like if you're a brain chemistry person, you know, there are brain chemicals people, you might say that pleasure is dopamine and enjoyment, excitement is serotonin. But the way to think about it quite simply is, enjoyment is how we get excited, how we get agitated by something. And that's not necessarily a pleasurable experience because, in fact, enjoyment is the pleasure which exceeds pleasure. It's something which is so pleasurable that it kind of overspills and becomes too much. It becomes like even horrible to experience. For instance, you know, one cup of coffee in the morning for the caffeine dependent might be, you know, that's exactly what is needed. And in fact, that might be homeostatic. Having your morning coffee might bring you back to a level of normal ease. Whereas three coffees, I don't know, I'm not actually that much of a caffeine drinker, but let's say three coffees in the morning might leave you a bit jittery. Now, this jitter, this overstimulation, this is the precise site of enjoyment that I want to work with.
Absolutely. And this, of course, for listeners who are usually acquainted with our episodes on Georges Bataille, this kind of excess, this kind of ecstatic, literally the ecstasy of getting out of oneself in excitement is, you know, Lacan didn't just take the wife from Georges Bataille, he took a few other things as well, to make a sort of a crude joke there. But let's zoom in particularly on this enjoyment, though, because there are two main sort of aspects, or at least modes of enjoyment, particularly in the framework you're using with Lacan, and that is phallic enjoyment and the other's enjoyment. Can we sort of distinguish those two? And maybe the distinction doesn't necessarily hold. Maybe there are intersections. I don't know personally.
Well, indeed, I think Lacan, in typical Lacan fashion, later tries to complicate matters. You know, like it's a common feature, I think, of academia, that you have the really good big ideas and then you end up thinking, well, how can I keep this train running? So the later Lacan tries to add in extra poles of enjoyment, like for instance, quite typically for Lacan, the analyst gets a special kind of enjoyment that only the analyst can receive, which is of course tied into Lacan's project of installing himself as a master. But more originally, he defines two poles, and this is related to also to his idea of formulas of sexuation. So the phallic enjoyment is what masculinity, not biological males, but the gender of the gender masculinity is afforded a phallic enjoyment, which is a direct line. So because enjoyment is what exceeds pleasure, you know, the kind of most typical examples we can think of in enjoyment, like the archetypical examples, are sex and violence. And in enjoyment, these two often come together because this is the exterior to pleasure. It's in the real, as it were. It's beyond symbolization, enjoyment at its purest. Sex and violence often come together as a pair. And in phallic enjoyment, we get there straight away. The classic example of getting straight to the enjoyment, I think, is best explored through death metal, really, because death metal hides nothing about what it is talking about. You listen to a Cannibal Corpse song, it is not just that it is here's some sex and here's some violence in a horrible combination, but it's also there is no subtlety to it. It is as direct as possible. The language is completely clear. And horrifyingly so. Now, the other's enjoyment is tied to femininity. And in Lacan's formulas of sexuation, the thing that really separates Lacan, men and women, is in on the level of enjoyment, is that men, masculinity is allowed to have enjoyment directly, go straight to it, in the straight line of the phallus, as it were, where feminine enjoyment has to pass through the social field. It has to be socialized or domesticated, perhaps, in order for the enjoyment to be received. Now, this means that it necessarily passes through language, the thing that constitutes the social field. And because feminine enjoyment passes, and in passing through the social field, the way it relates to sex and violence is contextualized, firstly, but also is given an obscurity through the form of a metaphor, basically. You know, you don't say it out loud what it is that you are talking about, this ineffable relation of anxiety and excitement to the thing that you're talking about when it's the other's enjoyment. Instead, you allude to it. You have an allegory that stands in for this impossible feeling. And that's the primary difference.
It's interesting to talk about the other's jouissance in this sense, in the sense it has to be mediated. I mean, is that part of the distinction between the phallic is immediate? Although, I mean, it would be interesting given that, you know, how much Lacan is taken up by, like, Hegelians, because Hegelians think that everything, there's just as much immediate, everything is immediately mediated and every immediacy is mediated. It's, of course, in Hegelese, so it's always difficult, but Hegel has a quote at one point that says, there's nothing in heaven and earth that does not have as much immediacy as a mediation. And when it comes to music, it's also kind of interesting because music is, I mean, maybe this is wrong. Maybe that music is a mediation. Maybe it isn't. I mean, it depends, I guess, on how you're looking at music. Are you looking at it as an object, as like something that a medium you move through, or is it something you plug yourself into in the sense of, you know, the vibrations literally move across the body, as opposed to there's a separate subject and a separate medium, and then the subject moves through it, and then, or it's attached to it in an abstracted way. It's for me, that's quite interesting when it comes to enjoyment. I mean, when it comes to genre especially, I mean, what's interesting with the example of death metal is, I mean, with an example, folks, this is for the audio listeners, I'm wearing a death metal hoodie at the moment from a band called Dying Fetus. So I recently bought one of their albums, Descend Into Depravity, and then I took out the lyric sheet because you can't understand what they're saying, you know, and then I was reading the lyrics and I was expecting, you know, some sort of quite stupid, you know, there's a bit like a not that faulty movies are stupid, but, you know, like the sort of the faulty zombie movies, you know, intense gore, cannibal holocaust movies like that. And I read the lyrics, and this one's called, it's called like Conceived Into Enslavement, what the song or something was called. They're all called stuff like that, folks. And I was reading lyrics, and it turns out they have strong opinions on income tax. And I got to admit, I was quite surprised. It's interesting how the genres destabilize, well, the concept of the genre sort of, you know, destabilizes against the object of the genre, which is a given album. Quick, the more you sort of unfold it, and I wonder if that dialectic is part of the process of desire. That's just me riffing, I guess. But I'm just wondering what you'd think about those sort of complications.
Well, so the thing that came to mind first is that I it's hard not to think of music as an immediate mediation, really. Like, the fact that it is sound vibrations in your body, like, it's an embodied mediation. And the way that we experience music is not, you know, when we listen, it's not this pure apprehension of the sense data. Suddenly thoughts start exploding when I'm listening to music. I start thinking about, oh, yes, that reminds me of this, that reminds me of that. This goes here. Oh, they're doing this feature now. Oh, that reminds me of that thing from over there. But at the same time, also, oh, this feels like this. This connotes this sense. I understand where, like, a narrative that they're trying to tell me, or an affect that they are expressing, or whatever. So I can't help but think of it as an immediate mediation. But I am in the privileged position of being masculine. So, you know, and one of Lacan's other aphorisms is that the phallus only ever functions as veiled. Like, it only we pretend, perhaps, in phallic enjoyment, to have this direct, unmediated connection to enjoyment. But really what is happening is the desperate attempt to throw off the signifier, to cast it away. But of course, that is an impossibility. And what you are left with is this half signifier, best exemplified in the metal scream, the which is not quite not a signifier. Mladen Dolar has this excellent section in A Voice and Nothing More where he tries to uncover what is the voice behind the signifier, the object voice. And this was picked up excellently by Rosemary Overell, who has an article about voicing the real through extreme metal. And I think that's very, very applicable there. To the point about the contradictions that emerge as we listen to extreme metal, and bands like Dying Fetus have this, they're less death. The interesting thing about them, despite the name, they're quite politically engaged as a band overall, and quite a lot of their albums have this more social focus. And I think that's the opportunity is there, but equally, I think the thing even there is that it's incredibly direct in its expression. The way that they talk about political issues, the way that they complain about income tax, is not the way that Joni Mitchell writes the song America. America? What the... Oh, botched that line. The California song. Pave Paradise, put up a parking lot. Which is... The title has just completely slipped away from me. But the way that metal bands, because they get to play in phallic enjoyment a lot more, the way that they deal with the social field is far more kind of direct and obvious than in musics that handle the other's enjoyment more. That would be my take there.
I think that makes sense to the extent that, I used to be a noise musician, used to play with a lot of metal bands. And so there was definitely a sense in which, in order to get on the stage and do that kind of stuff, inherently in a kind of, even outsider from the metal crowd, you had to sort of get into a persona of, you know, that the audience are trapped in you're not trapped in the room with the audience, they're trapped in the room with you kind of thing. And that's how you could do the harsh noise screaming, you know. I mean, it was always a good fun. It was never like a hostile, you know, setting. That was part of the fun of it. You know, there was a sort of sardonic sort of noise guy to come in and take the piss at you. I mean, even Metal Hammer used to love when I used to do that shit. But no, I get what you mean, though, those aspects of transgression. But I mean, guess we want to move it a bit away from metal. I mean, we'll keep, of course, pinging back to it. Because this is also a theory you're working on more broadly about music and enjoyment, particularly as it relates to wider genres and possibly even starting to provide certain, I wouldn't say taxonomies, but kind of general tendencies of enjoyment with various other genres. I mean, for example, in some of the stuff you sent us, of course, you talk about not only dance, but collecting as well, for example, also indie and R&B as more aligning to like the other's enjoyment. How would you sort of counterpose them to the metal examples?
Yeah, so the thing is, metal seems to be the most obviously related to phallic enjoyment. But then you've got clades of genres. Now, obviously, this is me being very rough-handed because I'm not an expert in these other discourses quite. Like, I like them, don't get me wrong. Like, I like all the popular musics, I listen to all of them, but I'm not properly as familiar. But I see dance music as kind of having some aspects of phallic enjoyment because it slips past language. It's not so concerned with the social field, but it has a difference compared to metal. It's much more focused on the body itself. Now, metal has these moments where it's about bodies and the things that they do, like in the mosh pit and so on. But in electronic dance music at the rave, it's bodies. They are bodies in spaces like you've never seen before. And the whole the way that nights are organized are around sustaining extended enjoyment for as long as possible, which is quite and it gets straight to the point as well. So there is something quite phallic, I think, about dance music, but then it's counterbalanced a little bit because the official ideology of dance music is all about generating positive vibes and a good sense of community. Now, not this is, which isn't as obvious necessarily in metal. You have your misanthropes and the like. So dance kind of has that this sort of middle ground, I guess, where embodiment is the middle pole. You might say that's the middle point of enjoyment between phallic enjoyment and the other's enjoyment. Whereas genres that I think of as songwritery, and this is me being, again, very broad, but popular music genres that are about writing songs for people to listen to and appreciate as good tunes, so things like indie rock, pop and R&B, a lot of folk music that they are drawing on themselves, it also fits into this. They are much more taken up with the other's enjoyment. They are all about not the crashing highs and horrible lows of like getting your limbs torn off, but the crashing highs and horrible lows of going through a bad breakup, of walking around in your town and not recognizing anything that's there, of gently crying yourself to sleep in your nasty two bed. You know, they're about real concretized situations that involve how we relate to the world, how we relate to each other. And that kind of genre is much more taken up with this kind of expressing the social, expressing the things that are impossible to say in the social still, because we are still dealing with enjoyment. So we still end up talking about the things that you could not ordinarily say in a conversation because it would be too much. It would destroy that moment or whatever. But, and I think the interesting thing there is because they're related to the social, these are much more legible, much more audible songs. You want to hear the lyrics. You want to be involved in the story. Think of Lou Reed, as a paradigmatic example of somebody who works, at least in the most famous parts of his career, with the other's enjoyment. Later, on Metal Machine Music, he goes the other way.
Metal Machine Music is, of course, the best Lou Reed album, second only to his collaboration with Metallica. But I just want to bring Craig in here, because Craig, you have, at least I'm not presuming anything too much on your part, David, but Craig, of course, has done the business in terms of varieties of genres, because I know he was a Las Vegas showman at one point, doing various cover bands, and, you know, No one can belt out a bit of 80s tunage like Craig here. So, Craig, I want to get your take on this.
Sure. Well, yeah, the truth of the matter is, and I am not embarrassed about this at all, but I did have a progressive metal band at the time of nu metal and played alongside some somewhat famous, famous nu metal acts. But despite all of that, I definitely don't have the grounding in musicology to maybe dig in the way that I really want to. But what I was hoping we could do was grab on to what I believe might be a particular metal tune that a majority, well, I would say all metal listeners know, and maybe those who, you know, grew up in the 80s or 90s might know, and maybe apply the Lacanian lens to it to see what the theory does. Because I actually want to pose a challenge to the Lacanian theory based on what I think are some of the historical antecedents that inform not only metal as a genre, but also the lyrics of this particular song, which is Metallica's One, right? And what's interesting about that particular tune, the lyrics were written actually by Lars Ulrich, who is referencing the 1971 film Johnny Got His Gun. It's based on a World War I soldier who has been essentially blown up, right? He's lost his limbs, he's lost his jaw. And here we have someone who's literally been completely disembodied by the effects of war. And one of the ways that I've perceived metal growing up and really haven't articulated this out loud is it's a way for the generation, particularly that came after the Vietnam War, the children of that generation, maybe a little bit before. I mean, of course, like Black Sabbath and so forth were like right on the tail end of that. But nonetheless, it seems like the metal genre is doing something to metabolize the events of the 20th century insofar as, you know, a lot of the themes are about war, totalitarianism, fascism, and the horrors of modernity, right? This catastrophic disembodiment experienced by the person in this particular song. And given that there is this historical determinant, like in the song, we have a song that has become such a, like, so iconic and almost a paradigm for metal music. How do we understand, like, what's going on with enjoyment in a particular song, like One, which is about probably the worst thing that could fucking happen to you, right? So you're getting a little bit, I can see the enjoyment in David right now. So take it away, David.
Let's fucking go. Okay. So let me put an let me do a Lacanian type aphorism for you right now. Heavy metal enjoys postmodernity. There you go. So heavy metal enjoys, that's the metabolizes is also appropriate, but metal is involved in enjoying the horrors of the 20th century and of postmodernity especially. I really liked what you were saying about it metabolizing Vietnam. Now,
oh, by the way, yeah, the song One is actually about World War One, but I think more like, I also think of like Alice in Chains' Rooster, not metal, but these days probably lumped into the broader genre of like metal-esque music, right? But certainly there's many songs of that type, right?
Yeah, indeed. So what's happening there? There's so many good layers to deal with here, because the character in One is a person who has no mobility, has no sight, has no senses. He has been deprived of all sources of enjoyment, basically. He cannot have an excited body. It is impossible. The only excitation that he can have is him tapping his skull against his pillow, which in the film he uses to spell out Morse code for "please kill me." Pretty good. Now, firstly, I want to suggest that One fits into a category of Metallica songs, the ballads. Every Metallica album from Ride the Lightning until the Black Album, after which there was some style changes and stuff. But for those, there are four albums where there's at least one specific ballad. And nearly all of them sound pretty much exactly the same, but let's get past that. But those ballads are where Metallica are able to be the most, it's those moments where they do the other's enjoyment the most, actually, because they have quieter sections here. The lyric, the vocals are audible. You can hear the lyrics clearly, unlike some other songs where they're less focused on social situations. The way the lyrics are delivered and the overall heaviness of the song tends to be increased. Now, as for how enjoyment works in this song more generally, I guess what happened, you know, the way the song is structured, we're introduced to the plight that this soldier is in, and then it becomes an increasing, a sort of circular motion of getting more and more agitated about this basic impasse. You know, he cannot move. There is nothing that can be done at this stage for this soldier. We are experiencing, by the way, fantasy. We are definitely experiencing fantasy because we get to hear the thoughts that would be impossible to communicate, you know. Zizek says that the essential stance of fantasy is to be able to say that I am dead. You know, being able to witness your own death is the essential act of fantasy. So here we are absolutely in a fantasy already, but it's this circular motion of getting more and more wound up, basically, about how he cannot leave his body until we get to this moment of phallic enjoyment, which fully breaks language, and we are left with a 2.5 minute guitar solo and outro with no lyrics. And that is the way it ends. We go through the social field and eventually we pass into phallic enjoyment. And now it is time for the ultimate phallic statement. Kirk Hammett is going to get up and go widdly, 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 widdly over and over and over again on his thing that looks like a penis. That would be my structuring of it for you.
Maybe just a quick follow-up to that. And then the the perhaps the irony or the tragedy that follows is a song like that has such a serious provenance becomes a Billboard chart hit and becomes then ensconced in the broader image of American and Western musical culture and becomes a commodity that then enters into this larger texture of various genres that appear on playlists and things like that. I was wondering the extent to which you think that maybe any genre, but perhaps metal in particular, loses a kind of vivacity, or maybe our ability to enjoy it then transforms now that we live in the age of playlists. Now that we live in the age where particular genres have been identified in such a way as to homogenize them, curate them, pop them on playlists. And it wouldn't be uncommon, for example, to be like at a Google Christmas party and hear one playing in the background. But we are not enjoying it in the sense in which Metallica fans in the 1980s and early 90s enjoyed it. What's happening there, do you think, like with music, with respect to genre and metal in particular?
Oh, this is a good political historical question to do with. I had some conversations the other month with some older people, some older music fans, and it was along the lines, and their position, not being musicologists, was along the lines of, well, God, it's so hard to find good music nowadays, you know, like nothing, the stuff in the charts just isn't as good as it used to be. And the normal defense that music fans my age tend to have for this is, well, there's actually so much good stuff, but it's just not being marketed in the way that it is because there's been a material decoupling of high quality creativity and the label system, which distributed that and made it possible. And that's true. But I also think there's a musicological thing to consider here, which is that popular music is in its mature phase. And people that grew up with the rapid changes in popular music through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they experienced the full development of a form in much the same way that people growing up in the first half of the 20th century would have experienced jazz as something which develops and gathers steam, which splits itself off and eventually becomes completely ossified, loses the essential vivacity, the vitality that made it so exciting to begin with. And to be honest, I think we are at that, we have been at that point with metal for a few years in a lot of fans' cases, we are experiencing much more like that now than we did 20 or 30 years ago. There has been a real change, and the way that separating everything into playlists, into genres, this excessive partitioning, this constant categorization and sort of neurotic divisions into sections produces a very different kind of enjoyment to the process of discovery. You know, when you're learning about something for the first time, when it comes to you on limited or unscrupulous channels, like I think of my era of illegally downloading music as, oh yeah, that was illegitimate. Oh, that was so cool. I got to explore the dark corners of the internet looking for Mediafire links. But my case compared to somebody that had to write correspondence letters in the 1980s to get hold of demo tapes, like I look, you know, weak, pathetic, you know, it's nowhere near as exciting. So the kind of mass homogenization of popular music and its complete recuperation absolutely has, I think in a basic way, has lessened the enjoyment per song that people have now. But in turn, you get this enormous quantity. You get quantity like you've never had, like quantities like we've never seen before. And that means that it becomes a much more continuous experience, not a discovery where we're looking through the margins to try and find these gems amongst the rough. Now it's much more a case of, I've constantly got a glut of good music to listen to. And on the one hand, that's more boring. But on the other hand, there is a constancy, there is always more to discover, and I'm listeners are confident in that.
I mean, that relates to a problem that I have. These days, you know, despite my metal predilections of the past, I'm a huge ambient music fan. And, you know, I admit I'll go on to a playlist on YouTube or Spotify or something like that. And, you know, I'm now in the oniric stream of ambient music and like, oh, that was a good one. But there's a very ephemeral quality too, to having that continuity. It just like an ambient music of all the genres most easily slips through one's fingers. There's no lyric to reference like, oh, I really like the part when the electric piano was like 10 miles away. You know what I mean? Like it's hard for me to grab a hold of the things that I like. And sometimes I have to wait for it to come back around on the randomizer. And it's created a very different experience of music that I had in the past. Like I can remember a time in the past, and here we are kiddies going back to 1993. I remember one of the new Stone Temple Pilots albums came out, and I rode my bicycle 6 miles to the local Kmart to buy it for $17.49 on CD, which is an obscene price even by today's standards, right? But it was almost like a mythic event. It was an initiation, a rite of passage. And, you know, nowadays it's so ready to hand that, you know, you would never have an experience like that. The cultural landscape has shifted in such a way. The economic landscape has shifted in such a way as to preclude that kind of experience, it seems.
Yeah, it's harder to have that kind of experience for sure. There are ways that we get that experience, but it's not as tactile, and it's also just drowned in a deluge compared to these like moments of extreme enjoyment. Like the sacrifice that you had to put in there for that example, paying over the odds for a CD, and you had to cycle. My God.
Yeah, the technological aspects of this seem to really problematize this idea of enjoyment, especially versus pleasure. Because insofar as enjoyment is, at least the way I'm understanding it in Lacan, is phrased in terms of an excessive stimulation. I mean, to the extent that long lived a new flesh, at least I guess I feel like I'm overstimulated all the time, and that you reach a plateau to that extent. It's less of a qualitative character, and it is a kind of quantitative meta stability. I mean, I have to, when David, when you were saying that you're getting thoughts all the time listening to music, I was like, no, I get the opposite. I put music on the kind of, you know, the thoughts don't come. I put on that horrible new Spotify DJ playlist, you know, sort of assembles random playlist for you. And then I'll do some work, and I'll do that so that I don't, you know, in a way to sort of, attune or sort of stem the tide of stimulation, or at least satisfy at a kind of base level, in the same way that, you know, hell, I've been putting on a fucking vape the entire bloody time. You know, it wonders, it's that the stimulation has kind of plateaued to that extent of music. Mm. And it's only really when I've been to live gigs and I've gone like, oh yeah, that was what it was like, you know, other than being, you know, all music turns into like, you know, background radiation, you know, background music. And then to that extent, I wonder if, when we talk about if enjoyment is synonymous with this kind of excessive stimulation, what kind of aspects of, you know, it's hard to keep within that psychoanalytic register now, I wonder, because we think about, for example, neurodivergence, neurodiversity and stimulation. That is much harder to quantify, because it's not as if we're categorizing brains, but I wonder if enjoyment presupposes a certain kind of neurological character, if it's going to make any normative prescriptions or any kind of standardization of what enjoyment is. I just wondered what you think about that.
Yeah, there's some really good considerations to deal with there, right? Now, Zizek is famous for pointing out that in our modern society, the command is not to be prohibited. The command is to enjoy all the time. You are being told to actually maintain, as you say, a kind of base level of enjoyment, a sort of constant overstimulation, a constant drive to be entertained. And this, I think that the thing to, but then there are these specific moments. That is raised as a bar, and now we are all beset constantly with our treat toys and our fancy sticks and our lovely screens and whatever. But yet there are but as that happens, live music becomes even more important. I think is what has to be understood there. Is like in when we are awash with recorded playback entertainment, the live version of it becomes so much more charged than it used to be. And that is also concomitant with a real material change that now buying an album is, well, in the past, buying an album and buying the gig probably amounted to similar expenditure. Your ticket for the recorded material and your ticket to see the show. And so you could, you know, and there was a choice to be had there. Do I get this one-time experience, or do I get the ability to replay my favorite songs over and over again? Now, when we are awash in the recorded, the live experience is much more charged with enjoyment, whereas I would argue that pre-recorded music increasingly looks a lot more like pleasure. It is returning us to a homeostasis of, oh, we're having our feet tickled all the time, isn't it wonderful? Whereas the stress and strain of going out to a gig, that becomes the contour, that takes on the contours of an adventure, a quest, you know. Every show that I go to, and I've written about this before, whenever I go to a show, it doesn't matter how good or bad it is, and in fact, the quality is totally irrelevant anyway. But every show I go to, a thought flashes through my head at least once, and it is, my feet hurt and I want to go home. But I want to suggest that that is actually the purest kind of enjoyment available, is this realization that, oh, fuck's sake, I'm tired now. And I got here through my excessive enjoyment. I pushed myself. I made myself go out. I interacted with strangers. I watched the shitty opening band, blah, blah, blah. And what do I get? What is my payment for this? Sore feet. That's what you get. But now, as for the point about neurodiversity, and normative claims about neurological structure, I think that it's worth point. The way I think about it, because I don't think I have a normal neurological structure. I'm extremely fidgety. I am riven with enjoyment, as it were. And that's not a good thing. I need necessarily, certainly not a rational thing. And normally, in our era, the rational and the good seem to be synonymous a lot of the time. Anyway, but I'm constantly twitching. I pick parts of my body all the time. It's gross. I definitely have ADHD in some form. Now, that's not a normal neurological structure. It may be one that is most applicable to enjoyment. And in fact, what I would really love to do in my post-PhD project is get to the conclusion that the reason that metal fandom is so full of people with autism spectrum behavior and ADHD type behavior is because metal appeals to that kind of neurological structure most clearly, because a phallic enjoyment is very much tied to the way that people with autism and ADHD spectrum behaviors tend to think about the world. There's a kind of directness to it that kind of matches on well. So I also want to, maybe what I would, to deal with that, I would suggest that maybe we can think of musical genres as also reflective of differences in neurological structure, perhaps. That a music fandom might tell us something about the position that the listener takes up relative to their enjoyment.
And if people want to go into a bit further stuff on neurodiversity and capitalism, of course, Acid Horizon did do an episode on Empire of Normality and Neurodiversity and Capitalism with Dr. Robert Chapman a couple of weeks ago. Sorry, shameless plug for our own episodes, but yeah, if folks want to look into this, absolutely go there. But yeah, I think that's part of the problem of categorization, the problem of taxonomy here, which I got a bit as Deleuzians and Anti-Oculus folks, we are always incredibly, you know, a little bit reticent about. But I guess we just have to find cases that broaden the scope of the investigation. I mean, so I think, because we've been talking about enjoyment so much, And even though we've already distinguished it from pleasure, enjoyment is not just feeling good. Nonetheless, there are so many things that will come to people's minds in which music is not about feeling good, or it is about expressing something else. Your music, for example, as the bearer of political ideology, or music as a bearer of, if for some people they're the same, religious feeling, or as music as example, I don't want to say political ideology because ideology has a pejorative term here, but in the sense of pain. I mean, I'm thinking about sort of the work of Fred Moten's book In the Break, which is about the aesthetics of the Black radical tradition. And in the first part of that book, and we did an episode about this years ago, where it's about essentially the foundations of the scream in, for example, the work of James Brown, tying back to sort of the scream that signifies a protest at being reduced to a commodity in sort of the prime work of oppression and slavery. And I want to ask, is this a limit, or is this a modulation or a modification of the idea of enjoyment as we pass through these different vectors, politics or ideology, protests, religion? How do these additional mediations come in? Because, of course, we've already spoken about Dying Fetus, but of course, Dying Fetus and James Brown, there's a bit of a stretch there. Even Joni Mitchell's protest songs, you know. I mean, there's an enjoyment, for example, of rebel songs as well, you know.
Indeed. There is, of course, there's a way that reactionary music fans take up their enjoyment in music that isn't about political protest. It's actually about driving the boot down. Now, what I want to suggest here is that music that is most related to phallic enjoyment tends not to have lyrics at all. It is about, because it is about getting to the ineffable. So a lot of technical death metal, you know, and to be honest, a lot of death metal particularly, but also lots of extreme metals more broadly, the lyrics can't be heard precisely to get you closer to that sense of full phallic enjoyment. Now, when we introduce a vector like religion, politics, society, it starts to become more like the other's enjoyment. It leaves this actually impossible pure phallic position and becomes socialized in a particular way. Now, the way that this, depending on the vector, I would imagine I haven't thought about this overly, I guess, but the different vectors are going to affect that relation to the social in different ways. Relating to religion, for instance, is more directing us back towards the ineffable again. Though, of course, religion necessarily passes through concrete individuals, social situations, and religious communitas, all of which are often discussed in the songs themselves. Politics, I think, is more obviously social. It's dealing with the concrete world. It deals with proper social situations as its fundament, as its locus. So I think, and that's kind of what I was getting at with the example that Craig brought up with one, is that when enjoyment is passed through one of these social, like a social vector, the music that is used to communicate that kind of enjoyment becomes more domesticated. It becomes more socialized as it touches more and more upon the social. And then as we get towards more phallic enjoyment, that socialization slips away. It becomes wilder. It becomes more distorted. It becomes less recognizable, and it takes us away from the signifier.
Yeah, there are some challenges that I have with this problematic. I'm trying to think how I would like to approach it. I actually have a question here on the page that might help us do it, and maybe it even has to do with, you know, going back to this question or this issue of the homogeneity of particular genres or their identifiability. You know, when we think of what metal looks like and sounds like, there's a kind of sonic and visual element to it, which is, you know, indisputable. You hold up a metal t-shirt, I know that's metal music. And I think we may have discussed this in our first engagement years ago, but you know, we live in a time where these genres have become more porous. But I've often felt with metal music in particular that there was a conceit that there was something that was so distinctly metal in some cases that any dilution of that would be something that threatens the genre, right? And in my lifetime, I've heard everything from progressive metal to atmospheric forms of metal to baby metal, right? And if we think of metal as embodying this kind of phallic enjoyment, well, what is happening then when, you know, we have atmospheric forms of metal or an encounter with Japanese pop culture and thus producing baby metal? Well, one of the sort of troubling distinctions here is between the masculine and feminine, because I don't know, when I see something like baby metal, for instance, that's not a particular song or a particular genre. There's not a song in that genre that I've really attached myself to, but nonetheless, there's a kind of community that forms around it. There's a kind of like a distinctly flavored collective enjoyment of a particular subculture. But at the same time, there is this kind of fascistic thing that happens in the traditional metals or the more orthodox view of what the genre should look and feel like. And when a genre like metal bleeds out into these other territories, what do you think is happening at the level of enjoyment? Is the phallic enjoyment being diluted? There's a way in which, too, that I always have trouble sort of contending with what I think are some of the moral implications of this, the ethical implications, which are bound up with in a kind of gender distinction, too. So how do we navigate that? What is happening when what we understand as orthodox metal either bleeds into or infects other genres or births new subgenres? And does that mean it becomes less phallic?
I mean, I think so, frankly. And that's good. Now, what I want to get here is like every music genre is very keen on saying we're different. Every music genre does this. Right, they are all concerned with what my supervisors called strategies of legitimation, strategies of differentiation. But that's how genres market, and also it's how the creatives discern themselves. Now, the thing about metal is because it is so keenly tied to this phallic version of expression, rather than differentiating itself merely through the quality of its works or whatever, you also have to have this annoying horde of wankers who go around saying, oh, this is the most different one. We are the most different. We've got difference down, mate. We're the best at being different. It's an overstatement on the level of the enunciation. That is for me, that's the particular thing about the way metal views self-regards as different. I absolutely agree with you, however, that this is quite right to use the Deleuzian frame of is fascitizing. It's trying to present an absolute. It's trying to set up pure. What's the Immortal Album? It's trying to set up pure fucking Holocaust. You know, it's trying to be absolutely differentiated, and this is an impossibility, just as the pure phallic enjoyment that metal pretends to direct us towards is also an impossibility. It's not actually properly achievable. You want pure phallic enjoyment? Get electrocuted. That would be, you know, that is where you get it. If you want that, be burning alive. That is pure phallic enjoyment. No wonder then that was inflicted sadistically on witches, right? It's the way that society took out its phallic enjoyment. Indeed, Adam has posted "Ride the Lightning." You know, totally right. That's exactly it. It's a statement of pure phallic enjoyment. But this is now bands like Baby Metal. Absolutely, they are leaving that. They are passing it through the social and passing it through the social in a kawaii way. And to me, this is very interesting. Precisely because it shows that metal is not as different as it states itself to be, and in fact is really part of a spectrum of responses to enjoyment or articulations of enjoyment that in total constitutes popular music. And so what we're dealing with here, really, we should be, I think, you know, break those genre walls down, destroy the genre machine, frankly. Like it's that, and without wishing to overly plug, that is kind of what my project Absent Signifier is interested in doing, because we do improvised metal where we're going to travel through all the different metal genres and also do random weird covers of Suzanne by Leonard Cohen or whatever else I feel like playing at that time, and just jam things all higgledy-piggledy, no regard for musical quality, no regard for any of the strictures of genre, and also drop theory in there as well. There'll be moments where we just stop playing and I just start lecturing for like a couple of minutes and then we resume playing on a dime, hopefully. That's the dream. So, yeah, sorry for the plug there.
I just wanted to highlight what I thought might be the opposing risk, which is, like, so in the case of Baby Metal, for example, we might deem that a success in terms of its ability to offshoot from the orthodox metal genre and then form a community around it. And maybe in Lacanian terms, what we have done is we have created this metastable aesthetic region where there's a certain kind of reliability with respect to the enjoyment, you know, the nature of the community, the identity that people have with that particular community. And of course, on the other end of that pole is the paranoia of cleaving to the orthodoxy, that if you go beyond that, well, then you are not righteous. Then the other side, well, maybe the more extreme end of the baby metal pole is then to conduct a kind of musical experiment. Maybe it's a metal musical experiment of sorts, the attempt to either create a new genre. So for example, like when I was in a progressive metal band, like one of the sort of attributes, I think, of that genre is you're always trying to hack the genre in certain ways. Introduce a little bit of funk, a little bit of rap, you know, how can we, you know, maintain a sort of atmospherics here and then do this complete U-turn into djent style riffing, that sort of thing. And of course, one of the risks that's entailed is not entering into the mainstream, not having your music become popular. And also, I think it takes a certain kind of listener who's conditioned to that kind of enjoyment, who respects these sort of, you know, left field experiments in the genre itself. Not everybody is keen to that and is dialed in enough to be able to enjoy that particular kind of music. And then the sort of historical problem that creates then is, well, then you've just kind of trail off into the diminishing tail of history. But other songs, like One, for example, will remain in the collective conscious for maybe another 20 to 30 years.
Hmm. And what we're seeing there really is interesting, right? Like bands like Baby Metal or a song like One is a liberal compromise. Let me put it to you like that. Like it's the handshake meme. You know, we're going to bring together. It's bad additive synthesis is the other, I guess, would be the other way to talk about it. We're going to take. Oh yeah, there's a section of phallic enjoyment, the guitar solo stuff at the end, and the really heavy section, and we've got some more others enjoyment in the form of this war story that's very personal. And we'll just shove them together. No consideration for how we could do a negative synthesis where they cancel each other out or explode each other. I think interestingly, the case where that does happen is in the Lou Reed and Metallica collaboration. That's where you get the but that negative synthesis is the avant-garde necessarily. It's radical. And as such, fucking unlistenable, horrible, not, and that maybe tells us something about how popular music is perfect for popular music as a broad system, and bringing enjoyment to bear on it is a really good way for us to understand postmodern capitalism, because the things that are popular rely precisely on these kinds of liberal compromises and additive syntheses. Those are the things that are canonized because they actually don't rock the boat too much. Whereas the horrible clattering experimentation is too far gone.
And when I was involved with music more intimately, the one thing that I noticed, and Public Enemies Bring the Noise in 1991, but then later on, all of that was a precursor then to what became nu metal. that for me was a, like when I got the Judgment Night soundtrack, that was my entree into a whole world of rap artists that I hadn't been familiar with. But then of course that particular movement or that particular moment in history exhausts itself. And now we look to the horizon to see which new experiments might fit a similar mold, you know, in bringing about the new and hence bringing about a new market. There's the compromise with capital.
I just wanted to sort of build up on that thesis. I mean, taking sort of your thesis of metal is enjoying postmodernity and then running with it, that is kind of the deterritorialization, to put it in Deleuzian terms, of metal, which is another way of saying, not so much it's mainstream, because I don't like the mainstream underground divide a lot, because I have a particular disdain for the self-importance of metal, who as a, let's say, a Manowar loving teenager back in the day. And to that extent, I think the self-importance of metal is something that you know, it is for everyone, it should be for everyone, and if you don't want it to be for everyone, you should go fuck yourself. But I think maybe you've listened to it, it's good music, it's good. But the problem is as well that it's so deterritorialized that you can get, you know, Mariah Carey in death metal fonts. Yeah, the font has been deterritorialized. You can buy liquid death water, you know, which is basically the metal water, and they sponsor stuff. There is that necessary compromise. But there's also an aspect of the counter-revolutionary, one might say, aspect of enjoyment there, when you start to enjoy the bad stuff. Like, oh yeah, that's, you know, when you say that's metal, you know. But at the same time, one of the things I think has been missing, perhaps, possibly from our conversation, we're talking about, you know, somatic feelings, cognitive or at least, you know, psychosomatic stimulation. But the thing that I think has been missing from what we've been talking about so far, and this is a good way to sort of a conversation to round things off, is images and imagination. Because what, for example, Mark Fisher saw in various strains of music, for example, the reemergence of jungle, and why he thought that various new popular musics haven't achieved a kind of imaginary, as well as looking back as sort of the hippies and the early soul movements, you know, these kind of very sort of socially conscious forms of music, is that they also articulate as an imaginary. Even going to, I mean, the mediation of actually stuff like, some example, like Detroit techno, bands like Drexia, the kind of Afrofuturism, the voyage home, the alternative histories there. And I wonder if, I mean, what is the connection, I guess, between enjoyment and the investment in generating new imaginations? Is there a kind of, I'm not saying accelerationist kind of potential, but are there any examples in which this enjoyment can be used to provide a channeling towards a kind of a subversive imagination of something beyond the actual, which of course is always going to be problematic, because you're always imagining something beyond the actual in terms of the actual. Shout out to Billy Cashmore, who has taught me that line. But I just think the imagination is just, I think I wonder where we would go forward with this in terms of thinking about images and imaginaries, to use that classic term.
Yeah, that's really good. So I think the thing, the first thing that came to my mind while you were saying that is that, you know, I was thinking, what is metal's imaginary? And I thought, well, it's an unimaginary, because metal's not actually very, metal is stupid. It's not very imaginative. And so the way that it generates its imaginary is often extremely retroactively, and at worst, just straight nostalgically. You know, it's just concerned with reviving the past. Now, a band like Sleep Token, which Adam just flashed up on the screen with the "Is there no alternative" epithet attached. The way that the thing that's interesting there is because they're like an ultimate like compromise, like recuperative band, in my opinion. You know, like they perfectly marry, right, we're going to have this section is going to be phallic enjoyment. We're going to have a big fucking guitar tone, big riff, whoa. And then we're going to have 2 minutes of something that could be like, it could be on the charts. That could just be a chart, like one of those chart ballads where someone gets really close to the microphone and does like male ASMR. And they are an interesting compromise because they have a complete lack of that. That's interesting, right? Because they have a complete lack of imaginary. The imaginary that they offer is basically like taking the sort of bedroomy miserabilism of 2010s soft balladry and making it a bit more epic. And that is the whole of their imaginary. That is what they are, and that is what they're offering you. Now they offer the cultic masks and stuff, but the way in which they but the cultic masks are very those two very restrained, kind of tasteful with it. Not like the masks from nu metal, where like they're really trying to be grotesque and trying to be gross. Now, you're thinking about how to use enjoyment, or like how enjoyment can generate an imaginary, I think is difficult in itself. Not only is there the issue that you already posed, like when we try to deal with the real, we only ever deal with the real in terms of the symbolic and imaginary to begin with. Like we can't get to this futurity without passing through our own materials, you know. But the limit experiences that enjoyment offers, I'm an optimist on this. I must maintain with people like Reynolds and Press, who were writing about dance music in the 90s, that there is something radically imaginative in being in a popular music experience, taking it in, I think increasingly at a live event. And raves, so Reynolds and Press talk about how raves are like the kind of, they are prefigurative almost, like they suggest a new kind of social organizing, and they allow us to imagine that also through heavy application of psychedelia. Now, but I think that can be extended to live music generally. When we go to a live music event, the way I think of it is it's always an imaginary because it deals with the thing that in neoliberal capitalism we do not experience properly, which is the public. When we go to a live music event, we are suddenly surrounded by strangers, people we do not know, and we find a unity in that alienation, to bring it back to something we were chatting about before. We are suddenly in the swarm, but this does not have to be a moment where we get caught up in the thrall of a charismatic leader. This could just be a moment where we recognize our place within the public and our responsibility of being in the public. And I think at metal shows, you see that on a small level, but also small dance and punk and all kinds of genre events. But at the scenic level, that responsibility emerges when you are asked to lift something for somebody else, or could you get out of the way, please? Or, oh, let's make way for this person who's fallen over, or whatever it is. Suddenly we become properly responsible for ourselves and each other in the public. And I believe that is the core imaginary that we deal with when we enjoy popular music. There you go.
Oh, what a way to end things off. And of course, if you folks want to read more about the public music and indeed metal, of course, because we're on Rapido, I do have to highlight, we got Shane Shapiro's book, This Must Be the Place, How Music Can Make Your City Better. We have upcoming Todd McGowan's Embracing Alienation, which is all about this return of the public through the alienation from one's private individuality. And of course, Bill Peel's Tonight It's a World We Bury, which I believe David did an endorsement for, actually, and we did an interview on this channel for Baroque Sunburst with, of course, Bill and indeed Fabian from Dawn Raid.
And maybe we should also say Enrico Morricelli, his book about the great psychic outdoors on lo-fi music and escaping capitalism, another good one.
And there is an episode on that as well. Also, Spectre of Hauntings conversation, Ravenna Hunt Hendrix of Liturgy, we also had her on as well. But there's not much left to do at this juncture than to say, David, any plugs, where can people find you? Where can people find Absent Signifier? And yeah, if anything else you want to plug,
okay, go for it. So the Twitter and the YouTube are metal_analysis. So find me there. Absent Signifier is, as I mentioned, is a band that we're just about to play our first gig tomorrow, as it happens. And if you live in the Newport area, obviously this episode will actually go out after the gig has taken place, so what the fuck ever. But if you're in the Newport area, please come to the cab tomorrow. It'll be decent. And but we play free metal. We're inspired by John Zorn, Ornette Coleman, and bands like Liturgy and Imperial Triumphant, the bands that are the avant-garde of metal. And we're trying to do that, but worse, and with gestures, live hand gestures and that kind of thing, so that we can tell each other how to move through through sections. We think it's going to be a pretty interesting band, so hopefully there'll be more stuff coming around that soon. But yeah, just follow me on Twitter, and eventually I will finish this PhD and there'll be more publications. I've also got a conference thing coming up next week where I'll be talking about gimmickry in scenic metal bands. So how small metal bands are increasingly using novelties and gimmicks as a way to differentiate themselves in an increasingly saturated metal market. Thanks very much, by the way. Really appreciated that.
No worries at all. If you folks want a general theory of party canon, you know where to go then. All right, folks. Cheers for listening. We'll catch you later.
We appreciate your support of The Imprint and the channel. Subscribe to Zero Books today on Patreon. Your material support helps us to promote a variety of perspectives on the left. Also, discover the many titles, new and old, that Zero has curated. Navigate to any of the links in the show notes to extend your support.